You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to episode 238 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast, sponsored by our friends Pagliacci Pizza. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Carcino.
And we are coming to you as usual in different locations. I'm in Boulevard Park, Washington, home of the Pelton Cast.
I'm coming to you from Renton, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 48 champion, Seattle Seahawks.
The 8-3 Seattle Seahawks, first place in the NFC West.
And sadly, we are not joined by Katie for the first time in like a month and a half.
We did three consecutive podcasts. If you haven't listened to last week's Thanksgiving food podcast, Let's Remember Some Thanksgivings, or our emergency pod after the Huskies come from behind win over Utah on Saturday. It took me a second to remember that was over. It's been long enough now. Be sure to check those out. The famous cousin Katie stands out there. The famous cousin Katie stand. It's Noah. It's him. We're very excited about it.
Stands out there. I love that you ran it back with Nate Duncan again too. You were like, we're gonna do something different this year, and you're like, well, but we're also running it back with Nate Duncan.
I mean, that wasn't in people's, you know, the listeners' feed this year. Previously, we had put it within the podcast or, you know, fully republish it. I just relinked to it because
you shared that to socials. Did anybody click on it again?
A lot of people clicked on it. Nate Duncan has many followers.
So do you, but never seems to matter.
They don't want to hear me talk about Seattle sports, but if it's Thanksgiving, that they're willing to listen to.
It's like the Peanuts holiday special, us and Nate Duncan talking about Thanksgiving foods like 5 years ago.
Yes, it is. It's part of the Thanksgiving tradition. Now, should we get to our beer this week?
Absolutely,
we should. Because you were unable to find this at Costco, where I picked it up earlier today. And that is from our friends at Silver City Brewery, the Old Scrooge Christmas Ale.
Tell us about it.
Intriguing notes of apple, cherry, and apricot abound from the long boil time, full fermentation, and extended aging of this dark, malty ale. That was not the word that I thought.
You seem very confused about what was going on.
Celebrate this year's release and save some for next, as this beer matures wonderfully when cellared. Well, this is not from last year, so this is a 2020 release.
Well, wait, can you hold that up and show me what kind of can it's in?
It's not cans. It's the
bottle. So weird. Okay, so somebody pointed out that we have a penchant for getting a lot of brews at Costco. And that we've gone through, like, the Costco reserve of different beers. I didn't see this at Costco, though, when I was there earlier tonight. But if you want to drink along for a future Pelton Cast, felt like this one might be a little bit much for me to drink on my own. We also picked up the Santa's Private Reserve Peppermint Bark Milk Stout from our friends at Rogue Brewery.
Yeah, that one, see, that's interesting because I saw it this morning, decided not to purchase it. I purchased two other beers that will be, one of which will be drinking on the pod in the future. Because I thought you wouldn't like that one. And then lo and behold, you go and purchase it. So what do I know about you?
It's just for the packaging.
It is. Oh, it's very nice looking packaging.
I'm against sweet stuff, but not if it's holiday sweet stuff. If that makes sense.
Nope, does not make any sense.
I contain multitudes.
Do you? Let's get to our toast. I got to throw one on here that we mentioned before the pod. Third Pelton brother, Mina Kimes, for her role in helping David Chang win $1 million for charity, become the first player in the history of Celebrity Who Wants to Be a Millionaire to crack the $1 million mark with her knowledge of Benjamin Harrison and his electricity in the White House.
Mina Kimes seems like she would be an excellent phone-a-friend also.
I gotta assume the crossword puzzle, there's a lot of carryover. I mean, this is not exactly the same skill sets, but a lot of carryover.
Oh, yeah. I didn't even think about that. Just kind of like random general knowledge. But I feel like Mina's pretty well versed in, you know, sports and entertainment. But also, most importantly, the first ever Third Pelton brother, as far as we know, who's ever been the friend in Phone a Friend on Who Wants to Be a Millionaire.
I mean, if you are a Third Pelton brother and have played that role, please let us know. We would love to talk about it.
Nate or Tyler, if you were ever there.
Okay, and more conventional tests.
I'm going to text Chris Smith to see if he's ever been one.
To the Seattle Sounders for their victory earlier Tuesday night, meaning their fourth appearance in the MLS Western Conference Final in the last 5 years. An incredible run of playoff success continues. We'll talk more about it later. All right, I may as well just write this into the notes each week.
There we go.
It's like its own segment. To Zion Tupuola-Fatue for the third consecutive week and the third week of the Husky season, named Pac-12 Defensive Lineman of the Week.
Wow. Like,
who else? He owns this award. Also, Dylan Morris, Freshman of the Week in the Pac-12, a second consecutive week. And Zion, further named, got the Chuck Bednarik Award as National Defensive Player of the Week.
Wow. And
as part of the Bednarik Award, which is presented annually to the best defensive player in college football.
That's pretty incredible. I mean, doing a defensive lineman specifically of the week means that it's a little bit easier for ZTF rather than just a defensive player from the Pac-12. But he might have won it each of these 3 weeks as a defensive player.
No, I think they do name a defensive player of the week, and it, for whatever reason, has not been him any of these weeks. Maybe they only name an overall player of the week, but I think they do. Which, yes, I want to know who's been winning all of these awards.
Rob.
If it's not him.
Rob for each and every one of them. Are you researching this right now?
Yeah, the Pac-12 website's taking a while to load.
They probably put Larry Scott personally in charge of it.
Nate Landman from Colorado has won it twice this season.
Nate Landman?
Week. Yes. I have no idea what position Nate Landman plays, but congrats to him.
A toast also to Nate Landman for some reason.
First I've heard of him, but a toast to him. Lastly, to women's basketball point guard Tamia Sandler, who was named Pac-12 Freshman of the Week for women's basketball after averaging 17.5 points and 5 rebounds in the Huskies' 2-0 start to the 2020-21 season in Las Vegas. She is the first Husky to be named Freshman of the Week since Ari McDonald in 2017. So it's been a while for UW women's basketball.
Nice to see somebody that is within UW basketball playing well.
Indeed. We will get to it. Should we talk quickly about food?
Sure.
We don't have a lot to talk about this week. We're going to have more to talk about next week. I'm very excited.
We're not teasing it.
If we want to tease it, we can tease it. Chengdu Taste. I don't know if we mentioned it on the pod when they first announced they were coming to Seattle, but we've been waiting for this one because I went to their sibling restaurant, Mian, in Las Vegas, and it was one of my better meals of 2019. So very excited to try this out. Would have been tonight, except we forgot that they are not open on Tuesdays.
Oh! So
it's pushed to tomorrow.
You did your Spotify Wrapped top meals of 2019. It was number one.
I don't know if it was number one. It was up there, though.
In the top five. Okay, so you said, is this true that you were going to have Nate Duncan personally curate the meal that we were going to eat from Chengdu Taste?
Well, that description is not. So he was one of the people I went to it with in Las Vegas. And he liked it so much that he said he went back to Las Vegas on a road trip during the fall and went there twice.
Wow.
Like back-to-back days. He loves that place.
Wait, so you didn't actually ask him to curate what you were going to eat?
I asked him to tell me what we ordered when we were there because I only had photos. I didn't have the names of the dishes. Because these are sibling restaurants, the Mian menu appears to be much more noodle focused. They don't have all the same things on the Chengdu Taste menu. So it's a little bit different.
Okay.
He can't curate, but he definitely sent me notes.
I truly just love the idea of you being like Nate Duncan from afar, right? Hundreds of miles away of you being like, Nate Duncan, what are we eating?
I mean, I got the full list, including the big all-star to me, which if you do go to Mian in Las Vegas at some point, the Sichuan cold noodles, his favorite.
Okay.
So there you go. Very excited to talk about that. But we did, you promised it on the podcast last week that we were going back to Egg Hole for a second consecutive week.
Or do I ever not deliver?
In this case, literally, it was delivered. And we were able to split three sandwiches this time. So we had a little more variety of the menu. And I wanted to do a quick rankings of the three sandwiches we've had.
Okay. Can you go through briefly the three different sandwiches?
So last week, I talked about the Friends with Benedict's, which is what I had that week.
Which is basically, you know, it's a traditional egg sandwich. There's bacon, and then there's like a soft egg that it should be runny, and then there's hollandaise sauce on top. Basically, the sauce on it is a hollandaise.
Correct. You had the Wok of Shame, which is local cage-free sauce scrambled eggs topped with caramelized onions, American cheese, and sriracha mayo. All these on a toasted brioche bun. And then lastly, the third one we tried this week, which I don't know if anyone actually ordered, but it got delivered. So that was great. Mm-hmm. The BEC smoked bacon, the eggs, American cheese, and Bloody Mary ketchup, which is part of why I was a little apprehensive about ordering that in the first place.
But just the word Bloody Mary is part of it? That bothered you that much?
No, I don't think ketchup goes well with eggs. I don't like that combo.
Okay, that makes more sense. I thought that the Bloody Mary aspect scared you away, and I personally was not surprised. But
I mean, I don't like Bloody Marys. I've never had one, so they're...
You've never had one?
Never had one. No, I don't. Oh,
I don't, you should try them. They juice. Are a delight. Spicy Bloody Mary? God. Okay, it's for another time. So you wanted to rank these three different egg sandwiches?
Correct.
So. You know, I'd only had the Wok of Shame before, and I thought it was great. And I'd heard from Mrs. Fantasy Genius some potentially negative things about the Friends with Benedict, which, to be totally honest, I didn't trust her on to begin with. Wow. When she said it, I was like, no, I reject this take. And I was right to reject that take. I think that they're all very good. It is extraordinarily close, especially between the Wok of Shame and the Friends with Benedict. But there's nothing compares to hollandaise sauce.
I love a nice hollandaise. You could taste it. I'm like Mrs. Fantasy Genius.
Yeah, I don't know. I was a little bit nervous. I thought she was like the people getting Yankee candles and saying that they couldn't smell anything in the Yankee candles. I was going to say, you couldn't taste the hollandaise sauce?
The Yelp data was pretty wild on the count scented candles this year.
I could definitely taste the hollandaise.
Yeah, I would say my takeaway is I felt like I wish I would have taken a little bit of the egg off of the Wok of Shame and put it on the Friends with Benedict's, because I think it would have made the egg ratio a little better for both sandwiches, actually. Mm-hmm. So that's an idea good egg. If you're splitting them.
There's a lot of eggs in the Wok of Shame, which is great.
Could use a little more in the Friends with Benedict's, although the bacon is quite good.
I want all the eggs.
Yeah. So I would say also, I agree that Friends with Benedict's is the best of the ones we've had. I would probably then put go with the BEC slightly over the Wok of Shame.
Really?
Just like having that bacon.
Their bacon is good. I mean, this is great. Having this location in Kent is really nice. I mean, just an egg sandwich anywhere. I don't care. Sign me up.
You're just in for any egg sandwich. I want to try the sausage, egg, and cheese at some point. I threw that out there, but you could not share that because of the fact that you do not eat sausage.
Mm-hmm. I don't dig on swine, except bacon.
So anyways, a late week for food this week, but more to come next week. Should we talk about the NBA? As we turn our attention to sports?
If there is NBA talk to be talked.
Do you have anything you want to discuss? Like from the offseason kind of quieted down pretty quickly after we recorded last week. Now it's
the weekend.
It's technically training camp, although teams can't actually practice yet. It's just individual workouts at this point. Well, everybody goes through their COVID testing, and we make sure that people are healthy for the start of training camp, which will be over the weekend.
Now, was it true you had your projections on ESPN.com today? Is that correct?
That is correct.
And I feel like these are up there with the thing that you do annually that makes the most people upset.
It's definitely up there, yeah.
Is there something else? Right, like the trade grades are kind of hidden.
The trade grades people probably don't feel as strongly about, I would say.
But the win-loss projections for their teams.
I mean, there's other stuff, like when we do rookie rankings. Anytime there's rankings, that's what's going to get people upset. And even though these projections are not actually rankings, people interpret them as rankings, especially because that's just how they tend to get shared.
Sometimes by ESPN social media.
Sometimes, although not in this case.
They didn't do that this year.
They did not that I saw.
Were you a little bit mad about it, though? You had the Lakers number one in the West. Is that right?
Yes.
It's okay. Like, oh, yeah, so you're good. You're fine. Yeah, as long as the Lakers are number one in the West, it does not matter.
Well, I don't know if I was fine. But the year the Lakers are number one in the West, that's the year they don't publicize my rankings as much on social media.
The Lakers need to be out of the playoffs for them to post on Instagram about it. Okay, so what kind of response did you get from your rankings this year?
So some NBA Twitter account just put the top eight with no context for like the wins projections, that these are statistical projections, no link to the article.
It was Kevin Pelton's top eight in the NBA.
Thank God, not even my name.
Just ESPN's top
this
eight.
This is ESPN who says ESPN says is going to make the playoffs, because ESPN to most people is a monolithic entity, not hundreds of individual people. Mm-hmm. I'm not just like one person out of dozens of NBA
Zach Whitman, personally, but
yes, that is fair. Just Zach and Mina.
I see her more as a Who Wants to Be a Millionaire personality.
Checks out.
Okay, so they just, and what were the responses to that? I honestly don't know this. I'm asking like I'm teeing you up for something. I have no idea.
So the Blazers are ninth in the projections. And therefore, if you look at that tweet, it's like, oh, the Blazers are going to miss the playoffs. When what actually happened is there's like a bunch of everyone in the West other than the Lakers are pretty far ahead out of everyone else. Then there's like eight teams that are within three games of each other. The Blazers just happen to be at the bottom of that group. Mm-hmm. So in the article, we also did your odds of making the playoffs based on these projections when we run 10,000 simulations of the season. And the Blazers make the playoffs in a majority of those simulations. It's just the other eight teams make it slightly larger majority of the time.
Okay.
But if all you see is this tweet that doesn't list any of that, it looks like I'm saying the Blazers are bad.
Uh-huh.
And so that's what CJ McCollum and Damian Lillard saw. I actually haven't seen Dame's tweet. I saw CJ's.
Oh, no. Dame did tweet, but you haven't seen it?
Yes.
Oh, Lord.
I don't know if you want to pull this up.
Yeah. Well, see what it says. You don't know if I want to pull it up. Of course. What did CJ say?
I don't know. Just like, I don't even remember, but they're very confident they're going to make the playoffs, as you might imagine, especially in the wake of what was, as we talked about last week, a critically acclaimed off season for the Blazers.
Critically acclaimed. I'm seeing nothing on Dame's timeline about this.
All right, well, maybe I got bad information about that. I think that was the famous cousin Katie's husband, Ben, who said that Dame and CJ both said something about it.
Yeah, I'm seeing nothing here from Dame. He seems to be having a feud of some kind.
Oh, I see. CJ just copied him, just wanted to make sure you've seen this at Dame Lillard. And then quoting the post where, of course, no context provided the
Dame's above projected it. Dame's above it to respond. He's probably seen the hate that you've sent to the Blazers every single year and doesn't even need to look at it anymore.
The Blazers do have a long history of outperforming their projections. Unfortunately, that long history of outperforming the projections does not include last season.
Tons of injuries.
Yes, undoubtedly. So,
were there any other responses from players throughout the league, or was it just CJ?
I mean, I don't see all of them, so maybe, but I don't think so.
That's really funny that it happened to be a Blazers player.
Well, I mean, first off, CJ is very online, so it's not all that surprising.
You're going to have to go onto his podcast and debate him about it.
He's among the most online. And I mean, look, I would love to go on his podcast and talk about it. I wouldn't debate it. I would explain it. Like, he didn't see any of the context of the projections.
I love that you think that with the added context, that this would be totally different.
Yeah, because people don't think probabilistically. They're just like, if you look at the way people describe the projections, they're like, ESPN projects the Suns will be the 8th seed. And it's like, no, we project that they have the 8th best projection in the West, but like the vast majority of the time, the team that's got the 8th best projection doesn't actually finish 8th. Because randomness is a thing that exists. And it's like not even just pure statistical randomness. It's also injuries. It's also mid-season trades. It's teams that decide to tank. Like, projecting is hard.
And you're projecting that the Blazers are trying to tank this year, huh?
That is what I'm projecting. I mean... I was going to say something snarky, but I'm not going to say that.
Wow, okay.
There are ways they could improve their projection. They, for example, signed a backup point guard. That would improve their projection. So.
Okay. Yeah. We'll see when it gets down to it, who's going to be in the playoffs and who's not.
We are literally 10 days away from NBA preseason games. It's just coming, man. 3 weeks from tonight, the season begins. Still don't have a schedule. We did get Christmas Day schedule. The Blazers did not make it.
Ah.
So that was the actual insult to the Blazers from ESPN, I think, the fact that they're not on Christmas Day. Should we talk about a team that did make the playoffs?
There we go.
And has advanced in the playoffs. Has gotten as far as the Blazers did 2 years ago. And that's the Seattle Sounders, who got a 1-0 win over FC Dallas Tuesday night in the West semifinals to reach the Western Conference final, as we mentioned earlier, for the fourth time in the last 5 years. The lone goal in this one from center back Shane O'Neal off a corner kick in the 49th minute. The first MLS goal in 6 years for O'Neal, who was not a starter entering the season, but has stepped up over the course of the year and become a reliable piece for the Sounders. They escaped an equalizer later in the second half when a shot went off the post, followed by Yaimer Gomez Andrade, the other center back, the other hero in this one, saving a rebound off the line with Stefan Fry out of position after dealing with the first shot. That was the most serious threat. And by the end of the match, it was really looking more likely that the Sounders were going to score a second than Dallas was going to score an equalizer. So it was, you know, it wasn't a dominant victory by the Sounders by any stretch of the imagination, but it was also a very solid clinical victory by them. I think that it advances them in the playoffs, survive in advance.
I saw none of this match. Doesn't seem like it was quite as thrilling as the first playoff match that they played.
No, there was only a total of 1.8 shot based expected goals in this one. So not a lot of great opportunities on either side.
It was kind of just a Tuesday night soccer match in early December.
Well, I mean, so playoff matches are often like this where they're very defensive. That the other two matches weren't necessarily in the East. New England won 3-1 over Orlando City and Columbus 2-0 over Nashville. So multiple goals in both of those ones.
Okay, so what's next for the Sounders now?
So they're going to be watching on Thursday night as they find out their opponent. That's when Sporting Kansas City will host Minnesota United in a game that was moved back from the originally scheduled Wednesday date to accommodate a national Fox broadcast in place of postponed Thursday night football.
There we go.
With the Baltimore Ravens issues.
I love that they wouldn't move the national Christmas tree lighting from, but a soccer match, they're like, whatever, move it any place, any time, any day.
I think those are a little different, I would say, in terms of... the change also actually made sense because they were probably going to have to move the Western Conference final either... Well, they were potentially going to have to move it, I should say. It was the Western Conference final was scheduled for Sunday, and if the Sounders had hosted, if Minnesota United wins, then that would have conflicted with the Seahawks-New York Giants game
at Lumen Field
on Sunday. Yeah, I mean, we're moving through these playoffs.
Wow.
Not the first week, but now we're moving right on through it.
How long they had to wait from the first to the second playoff match.
Yeah. I mean, the Sounders played the last first-round playoff match. Both Sporting Kansas City and Minnesota played over the weekend that week. So it's kind of weird that they didn't flip the Sounders to Thursday and leave their game on Wednesday. But it works out for the Sounders' favor now that that's happened because they'll have two extra days off compared to the winner of this Minnesota Sporting Kansas City game. Particularly a big advantage.
So it's definitely going to be Sunday.
No, it's Monday.
Oh, okay.
Move back to Monday.
Okay.
Thursday to Sunday would be too quick a turnaround. That's not allowed in the MLS. So
okay.
In the MLS Cup playoffs. So particularly if Minnesota wins and has to travel, if Sporting Kansas City wins on Thursday, then the Sounders would go to Kansas City to play that match because Sporting KC is the top seed in the West.
So we're cheering for Minnesota in this match.
Absolutely. No matter who wins, the Sounders will be playing them for the first time in 2020 because of the regional schedule for MLS, which was the same thing with FC Dallas tonight. ESPN's the 538 Soccer Power Index would heavily favor the Sounders if Minnesota wins and they get to host, giving them about a 70% chance of victory in that scenario. While Sporting Kansas City would be a slight favorite, thanks to home field advantage, if they win, in that case, about a 44% chance of Sounders victory. The net result is the Sounders currently more likely to reach MLS Cup than not, according to SPI, and the overall favorite to win MLS Cup at this
point. There we go.
Yeah. So, I mean, you look at the interesting thing that's happened is like all the other teams that have been in the mix lately are gone. None of these teams, Sporting Kansas City, I think won MLS Cup. I think they beat Real Salt Lake, but that was like 5 or 6 years ago at this point. And
I mean, the reason that they're favored is because they've already won this match. So it's basically saying one of Sporting Kansas City or Minnesota have to win two matches to
Correct.
Get there, whereas the Sounders only need to win one.
But the East teams have already gotten to the conference final, and the Sounders are still favored relative to them as well.
Okay.
And it's Columbus and New England over there, so two teams that have not been in MLS Cup in a while.
You mispronounced Toronto.
Did I? You know, sometimes you get on a roll, it happens. Toronto, which is not going to be in MLS. Oh, I say yes. It would be the first time if the Sounders reach MLS Cup that they would not face Toronto. And instead, after their early exit, their manager, Greg Vanney, stepped down from that role on Tuesday. So
wow.
some managerial turnover as we wait to see what happens with Brian Schmetzer and his contract extension, which, come on, Sounders, get this fucking contract extension done. What are you waiting for? Do you think you're going to have a better negotiating position if the Sounders win MLS Cup?
They're just this is the same as the Russell Wilson contract negotiation. It's going to happen. You think Schmetz is leaving?
I don't think it's the same as the Russell Wilson contract negotiations.
Wow.
Those were happening during an offseason with training camp coming, not, you know, the contract is going to be up when the Sounders lose or if they win MLS Cup.
It's kind of weird timing that it hasn't gotten done already.
Yeah, that's why it's a concern.
I mean, do you think there's a chance that that there are bigger things on the horizon for Schmetz?
Define bigger things on the horizon. I mean, that would be like a national team job, right?
Yeah.
I don't think that's on the horizon. The USMNT does not seem likely to be making a change at this point.
I mean, that would be the only one, right?
You would think.
Then that's it. He has probably the best MLS job there is.
But if they're not willing to compensate him like one of the best coaches in MLS, which he has proved to be, then I think he might be willing to go somewhere that is.
Why wouldn't they? Come on, Macklemore. Come on, Russell Wilson. Come on, Ken Griffey Jr. Like,
step up to the plate.
This is of no concern.
I just want Russell Wilson posting the video of him and Ciara in bed. Really, except this time they'll have signed Schmetz to the extension, not him signing the extension.
Schmetz is in the bed with them.
Now they're in a pandemic. No, no, absolutely not. Protect Russ at all costs, especially after seeing that Broncos game.
Oh, Lord. Provided he quarantined for 2 weeks.
I'm confident he didn't because he's been busy coaching the Sounders. So again, Thursday night, we'll know the opponent and the location, crucially, of that match on Monday, which will have taken place by the time we next podcast. Let's talk about UW sports, starting with women's basketball. We mentioned earlier that they started the season 2-0. They won their season opener 61-59 over San Diego State Wednesday, with Tamia Sadler, the aforementioned Pac-12 Freshman of the Week, getting the winning score with 7 seconds remaining. Sophomore center Quay Miller was the star of that one. Her first career double-double with 19 points and 10 rebounds. They then wrapped up their stay in the Vegas bubble tournament on Friday with a 77-48 blowout of BYU behind 23 points from Sadler. They held the Cougars to 27% shooting in that game. UW scheduled to open Pac-12 play this weekend with a Bay Area trip, but of course that's somewhat in flux because, as we've much more discussed on the football front, the restrictions in Santa Clara County on contact sports mean that Stanford can't play basketball at home either. Unclear what exactly the Cardinal are going to do. They canceled Monday's game versus San Diego after previously having their game on Saturday versus Pacific canceled due to a positive COVID-19 test on the Tigers roster. Stanford, which is number 2 in the country, beat Cal Poly 108-40 in the season opener, with 4 players reaching double figures, led by 19 from junior Lexi Hull. Fifth-year senior Anna Wilson, aka Russ's younger sister, made her 6th career start in that season opener.
Wow, I thought she was a volleyball player.
No, basketball. Huh. We can feel more confident that the Huskies are going to be able to play Cal, which is off to an 0-2 start with home losses to San Jose State and CSU Bakersfield. They finished 3-15 in Pac-12 play last season after former Storm player Sharman Smith replaced longtime head coach Lindsey Gottlieb, who joined the Cleveland Cavaliers coaching staff as an assistant. Cal and UW split 2 games, both teams winning on the other's home court. So, you know, the Cal game, an opportunity for the Huskies to get Pac-12 play off to a winning start and remain undefeated. How long that continues will depend on whether they're able to play Stanford this weekend.
As always.
Stanford, very good.
As always, we should have a disclaimer before these podcasts. All of this depends on whether the games actually happen.
Correct. There are asterisks all over the board. For example, we barely knew last week that UW men's basketball was going to be able to play some non-conference games before starting the Pac-12 season, but they got in a pair of them also as part of that Las Vegas bubble tournament, which wasn't actually a tournament. It was just games. An 86-52 loss.
What's the difference?
But, you know, there's not like a bracket and such.
They're all just games.
That's true. An 86-52 loss on Sunday to number 2 Baylor. And then on Tuesday, a 57-42 loss to UC Riverside, which
who
I gotta
scheduled
say,
this game?
It's just whoever they can play. Like,
at you know, whatever time, like,
yeah,
did they have to schedule around a tree lighting ceremony? It was like 1:30 p.m. on a Tuesday.
I assume it's an arena availability issue. I don't know.
I'm sure there are a lot of eyeballs on this one.
Well, I'm glad there weren't that many eyeballs on
this
one.
Was it on TV or was it on an app that you had to pay $30 a year for?
It was also streaming on the, not $30 a year, $30 a month.
Okay.
Yes. The famous Cousin Katie did it. I was wondering how much you'd have to pay me to watch these, you know, men's basketball games, because my takeaway from the first two games is we better come up with a new segment like Let's Remember Some Years for the early spring, because we're not going to talk a lot about Husky men's basketball.
Wow. Okay.
It's dire, man. They lost by 15 on a neutral site to UC Riverside. They were outclassed by Baylor in their opener. The Bears dominated the first 10 minutes of both halves, outscoring the Huskies 23-5 to start the game and 21-9 to begin the second half after the Huskies had rallied back within 12 late in the first half. The Huskies shot 5 of 24 from three-point range in that game, while Baylor went 13 of 29. So you can maybe write that off to, you know, this, shooting's going to even out a little bit. But then they played UC Riverside, and the Highlanders had lost at Pacific in their season opener and are coming off a 7-9 finish in Big West play. And the Huskies shot 3 of 15 from 3 on that one, 38% from 2. Their last lead was 3-0, and they did not score in nearly the last 5 minutes as Riverside pulled away for the comfortable 57-42 win. Riverside also crushed UW on the glass as the Huskies secured less than 40% of all available rebounds after adjusting for the fact that there were a lot more available on their offensive glass than their defensive glass.
I mean, they're just not a very good team. And I think, say what you will about it, but like, it's kind of the same shit that they dealt with under Romar. Like, it looks almost exactly the same. You have a couple of highly touted players leave early, possibly even earlier than they should have, although they both ended up being first-round draft picks, so presumably made the right choice. And there's not much else from these recruiting classes around it. Like, things felt pretty held together even last season when those players were here, especially after, you know, Quad A was ruled academically ineligible. You take away Naz Carter, and what's left is players who should be backups.
I expected them to be more competitive than this, certainly against a team like UC Riverside. I mean, bringing back,
you were going through these players, and it's just like,
well, a number of these guys were starting last year, including during the period of time where they ranked. I don't know, they were close to ranked during non-conference season. You know, Quade
they
Green,
had a couple
Amir
of seasons.
Wright, Jamal Bay were three of their key players from that team.
Really, really held together by a couple of players who are playing out of their minds. I mean, you know what Noah Dickerson did the year before, what Isaiah Stewart did last year, covered up for a lot of bad throughout the roster. At no point when you just never felt confident in Amir Wright and what he was doing. You never felt confident in Jamal Bay and what he was doing. Like, they were playing, but that doesn't mean that they were positive contributors.
But you'd expect guys to get better, and it just doesn't even seem like they've gotten better. And I also thought that the shooting was going to be improved this year because of Quade Green's return, the addition of Eric Stevenson, Cole Bajamo, who's barely played through the two games thus far.
Has Eric Stevenson done anything?
I mean, he's started. He has not shot the ball well as yet, but it's a pretty small sample size. But the Huskies are shooting 18% so far in threes, and Quade Green at 2 of 6 is the only player shooting better than 25%. Amir Wright, 1 of 12 from downtown.
Cool.
I mean, he's not that bad. He's not good, but he shot 34% on threes last year.
He's long-term not going to be that bad, is what you're saying. Yes. He's not going to shoot less than 10% from three. Yes.
The right. Other thing is they're just not getting enough rebounding from Amir Wright and Nate Roberts in the front court. They've been getting crushed on the glass in these games. And that was one thing again against Baylor. Baylor is a legit national championship contender, a reasonably likely Final Four team. But UC Riverside is not.
I don't know where it's going to come from. But also I'm just like, if it's hard to get excited about this college football season during a pandemic, I feel exactly the same way about this particular Husky basketball team playing during a pandemic. It's just like you and Katie were talking about it, and I was like, I just couldn't even be bothered to find out what the score was.
I mean, if I were a Gonzaga fan, I'd be pretty excited about this basketball season in a pandemic.
Great.
So the Huskies just 2 days away from opening Pac-12 play on Thursday at Utah, which has been cleared after pausing basketball activities following the positive COVID-19 test for head coach Larry Krzyzkowiak. Will be the opener for Utah, which is coming off a 16-15 season where they finished 7-11 in conference play. They lost guard Booth Gotch, who transferred home to Minnesota, but everyone else who played rotation minutes returns, and they add four-star guard Ian Martinez. They beat the Huskies by one at home in their only matchup last season, a game where Jaden McDaniels got a costly technical foul in the late stages of that one.
I was going to say, I was trying to remember that game, and the Huskies led most of the game, and then Jaden got like a pretty brutal tech. Yep.
I remember watching it in the Blazers media room. I don't know who they were playing that night, but I know I was in Portland watching that, streaming that one.
You know, you were cheering for the other guy.
All right, happier news, UW football. As we mentioned earlier, the 24-21 come-from-behind win on Saturday versus Utah, rallying from a 21-0 halftime deficit to win in the final minute. And on Saturday, fingers crossed, this is going to happen. Stanford comes to town, a 1 p.m. kickoff on Fox. The Huskies back in the rankings at number 23 in both the coaches and AP polls, and number 22 in the college football playoff rankings, one spot ahead of Oregon.
Oh, there we go.
Yeah, they're two spots behind Oregon in the coaches and AP poll. We mentioned earlier the restrictions in Santa Clara County. Because of them, Stanford traveled to Seattle on Tuesday and will prep for the game here. And then after that, they're going to go directly to, I don't know if it's to Corvallis or somewhere else in the in Oregon to prep for their final game pre the crossover week, their final scheduled game against Oregon State next Saturday. So it's going to be a long road trip here for the Cardinal.
Now, how is the college football playoff going to handle Pac-12 teams? You say that they're one spot ahead of Oregon, but you know, not that I think that anything is fair in college football. I don't even expect it to be fair at this point, right? You know, I think Larry Scott made his plea at the beginning of the season for an 8-team playoff, including the conference winners from all the Power 5 conferences, and was rejected because, you know, he's on the outside looking in, right? He's not coming at this from a place of power. Nobody's approaching it from a place of logic, right?
I have Larry Scott, a visual of him, like, pressed up against the glass, and in there are the SEC and the Big Ten commissioners, and they're like smoking cigars and enjoying life on the inside, and Larry Scott is on the outside looking in.
Is that not the way that it is with the college football
players? 100%
is. Like that, 100% is. The threshold for what you have to do in those conferences to earn respect or whatever, right? Because these things aren't played on an equal playing field. I think
the argument I would come back at that with is like, I don't think there's been a deserving Pac-12 team that has been snubbed. Like the Pac-12 teams keep shooting themselves in the foot. They lose at Arizona State in week 11, and that's why they don't get it. Not because of some, you know, because of an SEC and Big Ten bias. The reason the SEC and Big Ten get more teams in there, I mean, obviously the SEC, like, you know, like a 7-5 team in the SEC can still be ranked. But that team isn't getting in the college football playoff. The teams from those conferences that get in the college football playoff deserve it.
What is going to happen with this season, though? Should a Pac-12 team go undefeated?
I think it's going to be hard for them to make it in just because they won't have enough opportunities to prove how good they are, especially because of the fact that, I mean, there's a couple of teams that have actually played a full complement of games so far. But it's the same thing. Like, if Oregon went 7-0, I think they probably would have and won the Pac-12 championship. I think there's a decent chance they would have gotten in ultimately. But what the playoff looked at in ranking them prior to this week is, okay, they've played two games, three games, whatever it is, against crap opponents and been fine. But like, how are we supposed to compare that to teams that have actually played other real teams? Now, if Oregon had beaten a 5-0 UW team in the season finale and had beaten South champion USC in the Pac-12 championship game and stayed undefeated that entire time, now the story is a lot different.
So the situation basically has to be a team from the South and a team from the north need to go undefeated for there to even be a conversation.
Probably in terms of legitimacy. I mean, at least if it's like USC goes 5-1 and the North champion goes 6-0 and the North champion wins, then, or vice versa.
There's no other undefeated teams in the North. But I like that we're referring to it as the North champion.
I didn't want to talk about that.
Hypothetical. I'm just saying, like, in the South, at the very least, there's another undefeated team.
Correct. But who knows how many games who knows how many of these games any of these teams are going to end up playing.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's college football.
I think it's really hard that the Pac-12 did their best to make things as safe as possible and then is being punished for it.
Yeah.
Like, this would be the year, if there was going to be a year, to just be like, fuck it, we'll take the champions, right? Like, there's the front of ESPN. They displaced you from the front page of ESPN.
Was there at the start of the morning.
Yeah. Ohio State remains biggest X factor in status quo college football playoff rankings. If you take the champions, although I guess there's a question of whether they'll even be allowed to play in the Big Ten championship as well.
Correct.
But if you take the conference champions plus three, the whole process becomes a lot less complicated.
It also is different this year because it's not like you're cannibalizing other bowl games, because all these bowl games keep getting canceled anyway. So, you know.
Even you're for this. You of all people.
I think this year it makes more sense than normal.
If you were just end the whole bowl game system today.
I mean, I do think an 8-team playoff is better than a 4-team playoff. Even as a staunch believer in the, but I think then you should recreate the traditional bowl matchups as the quarterfinals. So Pac-12 plays Big Ten every year in one of the quarterfinals, no matter where those teams rank, even if they're the 1 and 2 teams, and that they play each other in the Rose Bowl.
Great, fine. Sure.
So.
But there's no fucking logic to do this.
Wow. Look, college football never started with logic to begin with.
Tell us about Stanford.
So they've got their first win on Saturday in the big game by blocking a Cal extra point that would have tied it inside the final minute. A thrilling touchdown for Cal, seemingly tying the game. And then the blocked extra point, which is, their second blocked kick of the game. Cal a little shorthanded due to players that are still in quarantine, and Stanford was able to take advantage of that. The Cardinal lost their opener 35-14 at Oregon without starting quarterback Davis Mills and leading wide receiver Connor Weddington due to a false positive test by another player that made them unavailable through contact tracing. Then lost 35-32 to Colorado in their home opener in a game that wasn't particularly close, or at least as close as it looked. They trailed 35-16 with 14:58 remaining, scored a touchdown midway through the third, but didn't get within 35-32 until the final minute. Then their week 3 game versus Wazoo was canceled due to the Cougars outbreak. So Mills has, in his 2 games, not yet been nearly as impressive as last season when he ranked 4th among Pac-12 QBs in QBR and won the starting job away from KJ Costello, who transferred to Mississippi State. So far this season, he is 10th among Pac-12 quarterbacks in QBR. His yards for completion down from 12.4 to 9.7. You think of the Stanford rushing game, and it hasn't really been there this year. Their leading rusher, Austin Jones, has been ineffective with successful runs on just 39% of his rushes, according to the EPA model as part of the CFB Scrape R. Still got 21 carries on Saturday to just 6 for Nathaniel Pete, who has averaged 8.1 yards per carry this season in his more limited opportunities with a 53% success rate. Passes to Jones out of the backfield have also been unsuccessful, producing a 33% success rate, but Mills has been more effective when he's targeted. There are 3 dangerous receiving options. They've got Weddington, reliable Michael Wilson, and deep threat Sime Fehoko. The Stanford defense, also traditionally a strength, ranks 11th so far in expected points allowed per play. They have gotten 3 sacks in the last 2 games from defensive end Thomas Schaefer, but the rest of the team has just 2 combined all season, which is 3 games.
It's just 3 games, right? Like,
Stanford has not played well. It's only three games, but they have not played well.
And I'm never going to go into a game against Stanford feeling that confident.
I mean, things looked very good for the Huskies on paper, not this time a year ago, but earlier a year ago when they headed to Stanford. They were ranked. Stanford was unranked in that game, and they got pretty well thoroughly crushed. But
it does seem like at Stanford has been a little bit more difficult.
Do you know, trivia, I didn't put this in the notes, trivia this week. Who was the last Husky coach to win at Stanford Stadium?
The last Husky coach to win at Stanford Stadium. Wow. I'm going to guess that it was Neuheisel.
No, it's not that bad. It's Tyrone Willingham.
Oh, Tyrone Willingham won at Stanford.
Back in familiar territory, yes. I believe that was 2007. The Huskies won. Or no, it wouldn't have been 2007. I don't know. Maybe. Yeah, I guess it was 2007.
Okay.
So they've lost, even a lot of very good UW teams have lost at Stanford, but they beaten the Cardinal at home the last two times they've come here.
I mean, I think that basically every loss, not every loss to Stanford during that time period, there are times that Stanford is just a better team, but the last 6 years or so, they've generally had a better team than Stanford has had overall and have lost in Stanford.
Davis Mills really torched the Huskies last year, 21 of 30 for 293 yards and a touchdown. Jacob Eason was 16 of 36 for 260 yards.
Oh, such an awful game. It's so hard to really tell. I mean, I think this is a good UW team. We still don't. We know a few things about them. You know, I think we can confidently say that the secondary is pretty good. And I think we can confidently say that they should be able to generate some kind of pass rush. Beyond that, we don't really know. Are they a good running team? Maybe, maybe not. Are they a good passing team? Maybe, maybe not. Can they put together one of those two things on Saturday? Hopefully.
We know one thing. Kadon for Heisman.
Oh, yes. Kadon for Heisman, ZTF for the Bronco Nagurski Award, and the Ben Derrick. He wants it all. But it's really tough to know. I mean, there's times that you go an entire college football season where you don't actually really know what you have on your hands, you know, and we're trying to do that now in a few games, one of which they had, you know, 4 days to prepare for the other team, for the opponent. Like, it's all just kind of randomness. I think that the Huskies probably have a better team than Stanford. I think that they probably have, you know, they have some sort of home field advantage, even if it's a slight home field advantage.
Stanford will be able to adjust to the time zone since they're coming in so early.
You know, has it played out that in the NFL, home field advantage is basically the same as it's ever been?
No, I happen to see, you know, it's less. I happen to see there was an AMA today, including Michael Lopez, who's in the NFL's statistical analysis department, and he mentioned it was 52% home field win percentage this year as compared to 56% recently.
Okay, so it actually has made a difference.
Yes.
Not having fans. Okay. So, I don't know. Percentage chances of victory? 73%.
Yeah, I was going to go 75%. That sounds about right.
We'll just see.
We sure will. Other thing to note, by the way, if you watch that Oregon game, you'll recall that senior kicker Jet Toner.
Oh, God, do I hate Jet Toner.
Why?
He's just one of those players. Like, you don't see it quite as much in football as you do in basketball, where they're just
like they're here for 4 years.
They are around forever, and they're always annoying, and that is Jet Toner.
I don't think Jet Toner is annoying. I wouldn't go so far as to say I once hung out with Jet Toner's family, but his family was once in the same room as I was because I was staying at a hotel across the street from the Stanford campus the night of their season opener 2 years ago.
This is like the lowest stakes, like not trying to burn your sources or whatever.
I'm not trying to. There's not sources. But a bunch of people wearing Jet Toner jerseys walked in. It was pretty noticeable.
Haven't these kids been through enough? That's you. with Jet Toner and be like, Jet Toner's family is lovely. I saw them from afar one time.
He missed all four of his field goal attempts at Oregon, but has made all four since then. So seems to have regressed to the mean.
Good for Jet Toner. I'm going to have to talk about the Seahawks here. Yeah. Are we gonna talk about this Eagles game?
I mean, we didn't do an emergency pod. There did not seem to be any demand for an emergency pod. There wasn't that much to say about
this
game.
There was no emergency happened.
Like, it kind of played out like we expected. The emergency was the Hail Mary. That was the only emergency.
I mean, I kept telling you on the chat that the game was over. And
there was
the
a heated argument about whether the Seahawks should have kneeled out their final possession. Not the possession after the onside kick, but the possession before that that ended in the field goal to make it 23-9.
Mm-hmm. And I was right.
Were you?
Yeah. The reason it was 100%, this is like, it's the same fucking thing of like, well, you know, the polls, they were off, so you can't trust these percentages. It's like, it's off because if something crazy happens, you still can withstand it and win. That's why it was 100% chance of victory, because they were able to withstand the most improbable thing happening, which is Carson Wentz literally throwing the ball to the end zone and somebody catching it.
Look, Carson Wentz, I don't think that ability to throw a Hail Mary is particularly strongly correlated with ability to throw the ball in a normal situation.
Man, getting the ball down the field has not been great for Carson Wentz.
No, but like in a Hail Mary, it's not like you need pinpoint accuracy. You just throw that fucker up there and hope somebody comes down with it. That Carson Wentz could do.
So many improbable things had to happen to get to that point where it was even a 6-point game. Yes.
All right.
You don't think that those were improbable things? That Eagles team driving down the field, even then, even if they get the ball back down 6 points, they still weren't going to win the game. I mean, what are the percentage chances of getting an onside kick in the NFL?
They're low. Especially minuscule. If you don't have...
Younghoe Koo.
Yeah.
Yes.
Now, I was saying that the ESPN win probability... I don't trust it as much as the Ben Baldwin win probability, which had the Seahawks at 99.7% at the time that you were trying to kneel it out.
0.3%.
I also don't know that there's that much harm in just, you know, running a run play.
It's kind of crazy how different you and I feel about, like, runs at the end of a half that are meaningless runs. I want to kneel those every time.
I mean, that, yes, because there are some things that could go wrong. You could fumble in that situation.
It's about the fumbling and the injury risk. What's the point?
But in this case, I don't think you take any risks.
You don't take any risks? That's why you kneel. What are you talking about? The safer play is to kneel.
No, the safer play is to try to run out the clock so the Eagles never get the ball back in the first place.
I guess so. Whatever. Maybe if you bet $500,000 on the game or whatever, $50,000 in the game.
Well, if you bet on the game and had the Seahawks giving 7 points, it was a...
Then you were running. Very, you're like, they should pass even.
Very distressing finish for you. I wasn't sure they shouldn't pass because I was sweating out a very close fantasy football finish where I beat a team that had Russell Wilson in one of the Pelton Cast leagues by 0.72 points, I believe.
You probably scored like a 68 and stole one.
Well, it was a little better than that, but that was the league where I accidentally started killing Bellage and was saved by the bell on that one.
Was this the Champions League?
It was.
I'm not going to be in the Champions League next year. With all of these points, you accidentally started Kalen Ballage and are going to be in it.
I was on Twitter literally the entire morning, and there was no updates about Kalen Ballage. I didn't even know it was that
close a call.
Baby
Fantasy Genius knew and you didn't know.
It was on the ticker?
I don't know.
I should have had him call me. I would have started Wayne Gallman. He had an 18.1. I would have had a great score if I had started Wayne Gallman.
Are the points for and the points against are not updated yet, correct? Because this week is technically not over.
Oh, yeah. This week is much like that game in St. Louis. This week is not over.
I've scored 150 or so more points than you have. Oh, wait. That was Katie that I was looking at. Never mind. What team is yours? Oh, you're even worse. God, I hate you.
Oh, no.
And you're comfortably in the... You're not comfortably in the playoffs. You're on the fringe.
I am not comfortably in the playoffs. I need to win out to make the playoffs because I don't know if you've noticed, I don't win a lot of tiebreakers. I have no points.
I will be like 230 plus more points than you this week. If you stick in this league, there's going to be a Champions League without either of us in it next year.
Knock on wood, I'm feeling pretty good about the Champions League in my other league.
Oh, you'll get there from being... Oh, God.
Yeah, that's the upside of having two teams. It is, as you've noted, much easier to get into the Champions League.
Great. But well, congrats.
That league I won to get to 8-4 this week, so I'm in good shape. But the Third Belton brother, Ben Baldwin, is running away with that league. His team is going to 11-1.
I would have only beaten you by like 10 points in this league. It wasn't that dramatic.
It was not.
Okay, anyway. Also the intentional grounding. It has to be discussed. I'm sorry. Like,
you are so... You and Zach, the Belton brothers, Zach Rubin, just both...
It is literally the worst call I have ever seen in my entire life. Because there is nothing objective about it. The play that made them...
You mean there's nothing subjective about it?
Because there's nothing subjective about it at all. The play that made them... Wait, let me start that over. Hold on.
No.
Delete that. No, delete that, no. Motherfucker. Delete it! It is literally the worst call I have ever seen in my entire life. Because there's nothing subjective about it. Literally, the call that made them make pass interference reviewable in the Saints-Rams NFC Championship game was a subjective call, right? Like, it was probably pass interference, but I could see an argument be made that it wasn't, right?
What about when Vinny Testaverde scored a touchdown with his helmet?
That's not a call, though. I mean, that's...
I think it is a call.
I feel like there is a part of it where the view was obscured. None of those elements were at play.
Colorado once won a national championship because they got five downs instead of four because they forgot to put the down marker to where it was supposed to be.
I'm talking in the NFL only. Look, college, we are not counting.
Well, as you far, said ever seen.
As far, the worst call in the NFL that I've ever seen. Literally, a ref stands there and watches the ball hit 3 yards, 2 yards short of the line of scrimmage. There's nothing subjective about it. The ball did not reach the line of scrimmage.
I want to just know what was going through the linesman's head on that call.
He stood and watched it. You can see, I love that Ben posted the tweet circling his face or whatever, looking at the ball hitting. He's holding the line of scrimmage marker. Like, did he think that it went past him? Am I wrong here?
He must have choked.
It, honestly,
like, there's no other explanation.
Ruined watching the rest of the game for me.
The game, again, the Seahawks won despite that call.
Because they should not have given up that touchdown. It should not have been as close of a game as it was. And it was just like brushed past. Nobody was like, whoa, that was a really awful call. This should have been like the fucking Zapruder film with them breaking down how terrible of a call it was. Look, we had 45 minutes of defense of Carson Wentz, the worst quarterback in the NFL after that. It was constant.
Carson Wentz isn't going to defend himself.
Good God. That was just, the whole thing was, Mike Sean Dugger had a tweet where he was like, people often call games ugly and say that's because there's not a lot of offense. And I'm like, dude, this game was ugly. Like,
oh, that game was ugly. I mean, it was good. There was good defense, but it was worse offense for sure.
And it wasn't even, like, I think the Seahawks played fairly well in defense, but also they gave up probably too many drives to the Eagles. I mean, the fact that they were in this situation, but it's stuff like that that is ugly. It's watching this broadcast and having to hear, it's the Eagles bringing in Jalen Hurts for two snaps, him completing a pass and then being like, back to Wentz. Here we go. I would rather the Seahawks have had a lower chance to win the game than have watched Carson Wentz take snaps under center.
This is, again, a place where we philosophically disagree. Give me all the Jalen Hurts you can after this week. But I was just fine with Carson Wentz last Monday.
Jesus Christ. It's just like, as a competitor, you know, it's one of those things where you don't cheer for your opponent to be injured. You don't cheer for your opponent to have Carson Wentz as their quarterback.
I do on that one.
You cheer for the opponent to be injured?
No, that's why I said, for them to play Carson
How
Wentz.
Can you be Doug Peterson and be like, I'm statistical mind in everything I do, and not look at the stats of that your quarterback is fucking god-awful in every single statistic?
Have you considered, what if Jalen Hurts is worse?
I don't, at least something, right? And oh my god, the Eagles are a train wreck.
They really are. Well, how about their strategy of beating up DK Metcalf, which resulted in two personal fouls on the first drive? Great strategy, guys.
Beating up
DK Metcalf. It definitely worked. Sure, just didn't do anything after that, did he?
The first one, I think DK kind of instigated, and then, you know,
DK, he's living on an edge right now. Like, I remember Marquise Chris's year at UW, where like every time there would be some sort of altercation and the other player would get a technical. About DK right now.
If he gets a penalty at some point, it's not that big of a deal, right? No. You can withstand one flag.
But both of the personal fouls he's drawn have been, in those situations, have been pretty important penalties.
The other piece, I have to come back to this. I'm sorry, I can't not. This Carson Wentz thing, it was just like every second, it's like I couldn't believe what I was hearing on this broadcast. And look, we hear all sorts of things that would be labeled by Twitter as disinformation or proven incorrect on broadcast. Every single game, right? We hear that. But the defense of Carson Wentz, it just kept going. It wasn't like, I don't know if you can make a change here. It was just like over and over and over again. And the argument that they should not turn to Jalen Hurts because they're in the playoff hunt at 3-7-1. It's just like, whatever. If you make the playoffs, who cares?
By the way,
The Eagles are not in the position to be caring about moral victories of making the playoffs, right? Being like, we made the playoffs. Or whatever. Like, this is not the future of your organization, of your franchise. Have some respect in yourself, Eagles.
Yeah, the future of the organization is the amount of money you have committed to Carson Wentz that allows you to not move on from him for several years.
They're going to have to just rip the Band-Aid off. They're going to have to
eat it. You said during our chat, I know that these are off limits generally, but going back to the personal foul involving DK Metcalf, that we should not let that call because it happened immediately after a 2nd-and-14 run with Chris Carson for 3 yards that would have left the Seahawks 3rd-and-11 from the 19 or 22.
I did. I managed to forget that.
See?
Oh,
it's good thing I looked it up.
It wasn't look, when you had that non-intentional grounding call happen after that, everything else was gone. They should be changing rules this offseason because of how bad. Did Pete Carroll, did this come up?
I didn't listen to the Pete Carroll show. I forgot about it because it wasn't a Monday, so it threw me.
God. Whew. Anyway. It's funny, in a fairly comfortable victory for the Seahawks, it just left the game being like, we won.
Well,
that's great.
I mean, the real reason for angst going forward is that Carlos Dunlap left the game with a foot sprain, and we do not yet know the severity of that. He was supposedly set to undergo an MRI Tuesday morning. You asked me what it means. I told you that it means that he sprained a ligament in his foot. But there's such a variety of degrees of sprains, and we also don't know which ligament, that it's hard to say what that actually means in terms of how long he'll be out, or if he'll be out at all, I guess.
I mean, Pete Carroll could tell us literally anything, and it would not help.
As someone who has Chris Carson on his fantasy team, the fact that he was so limited in snaps after the no restrictions thing would have really annoyed me if he hadn't scored a touchdown.
I think another topic has to be just how bad the run game was, though.
I'm not that concerned about it. I mean, the Eagles are a good run defense, and they were kind of selling out to stop the run. You don't think so?
I mean, they were, but it was so bad.
It also seems like Cedric Ogbuehi might not be great. It's very possible that Brandon Shell is better than him at right tackle.
This was, what was the year? Was that 2017 that the Seahawks were 7-9 and missed the playoffs?
I think it was 16. I guess it was 17, yes.
This looked like a Tom Cable run game.
I'm not as concerned about it as you are.
I'm not, I don't know if I'm concerned about it, but it was bad.
Yeah, it wasn't great. Definitely wasn't great. Can we talk about how awesome DK Metcalf was a little
bit? Oh, God.
Like, can DK Metcalf just play all of his games at, what is it, still Lincoln Financial Field? Whatever the name of that.
At the Link. I don't think we need to say that, because DK Metcalf is good anywhere.
He's good anywhere, but he really destroys the Eagles, and there's, you know, constant single coverage. They brought in Darius Slay in part to handle matchups like this after DK Metcalf destroyed them in last year's playoff game. And then DK Metcalf was even better this year against Slay.
I mean, he leads the NFL in receiving yards. Like, to say that he has to play every game at the Link. Yeah.
I'm not saying but I'm just saying, like, you know, he's good everywhere, but he's better there. This is really something, man.
When he's also averaging, you know, 18 yards per reception, like, this isn't, he is.
Those are Justin Jefferson numbers.
He has more yards than Justin Jefferson.
I'm joking.
But he's the best receiver in the NFL.
I don't know if I can quite get there, but he's right up there.
And what is it going to take for you to get there?
He's still only like number 4 in DR.
Hmm. Okay.
Wow, you know he's number 1 in DR. Justin Jefferson is not number 1, as it turns out.
Really?
The leader in DR is not going to be adding into his total for a few weeks here.
Oh, Will Fuller.
Will Fuller. Ouch. Will Fuller. Tyreek Hill, the other person who's ahead of him. I don't know. He might be the best receiver in the NFL. Might be. I don't know if I necessarily believe in the three players ahead of him that much.
You don't believe in Tyreek Hill that much?
Well, I'm just saying, I don't know that I think that Tyreek Hill is the best receiver in the NFL. I think DK obviously benefits from his quarterback, but I think so does Tyreek Hill.
But some of the balls, like the separation that DK had on some those catches.
Lack of separation that he had.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Yeah. Like, this isn't Tyreek Hill standing with a mile around him. I would assume that the amount of space that they have, the amount of separation that they average, is wildly different.
I saw a tweet at some point last night, the average separation was like less than 2 yards on his catches. So.
It is incredible to watch. I mean, you talked about that DK is going to be like an incredible diva in a couple of years. And
that's my fear.
It's true with every great wide receiver. Like, whatever you take it. If you have, like, that would be a great problem to have.
This is true.
So I think it's also a little bit different where this team is so clearly established as Russell Wilson's team. Like, DK is coming in 8 years into Russell Wilson's career.
Sure. Terrell Owens came in a long time into Steve Young's career.
Okay. Great.
I don't know if that necessarily determines things, but yeah, again, it's a good problem to have if it gets to that point.
I think there is a difference between the Seahawks, who had issues between the defense and the offense, you know, adjusting to the second phase of the, you know, Pete and Russ tenure, and Russ kind of being the new guy and needing to establish himself. And now Russ is the old guard.
And we are just so old.
We're the very, very old guard who remember a time before Matt Hasselbeck.
It's true, youngins. Believe it or not, it is true. The other topic I had, I don't want to say anything about it, but just Jason Myers. Respect.
Yeah?
You anything you want to touch on before we get to the Giants?
Okay, so he looks down 2 full yards between the ball and the line of scrimmage.
Do we know who it was on the Seahawks staff who caught that ball?
I don't know.
I pulled up the tweet from Ben earlier. I don't know if it was clear from there.
I mean, I don't think that he did anything wrong by catch. There's no rule that the ball can't be touched.
This isn't
a Bartman type situation, right? No, like,
I'm not trying to ascribe blame to anyone here. I just thought that was an interesting question.
He probably caught it because he was like, "Well, I'm a million fucking miles from the line of scrimmage. This is obviously intentional grounding." Just when you're watching the play happen, right? The Eagles are driving. I'm actually still so consumed by this. The Eagles are driving and the ball sails over Carson Wentz's head. And you're like, this is going to be good. You know,
it was a 30-yard penalty.
Something. And that's the difference. It wasn't like, and they just called, was it the previous series that they called Russ for intentional grounding on a play where it's like, it probably was intentional grounding, but you could make an argument.
It clearly was intentional grounding.
But you could make an argument that the receiver was making their way over there and got held up by a defender. Like, it's not the most absurd argument to make. But this was like, there's no argument. It is cut and dry. If you're going to be intentional
grounding. Are you
going to
be over it by Sunday?
I don't know. God. We'll see. Are you going to be over it by Sunday? I've said my piece. That's it. I mean, I haven't gotten to talk about this with anybody. All I'm doing is they're having children like jump on me and blow their fucking recorders in my ear. We're watching this football game and there's intentional groundings that are not being called. It's like, what am I supposed to do here?
This is the downside of not being able to watch games with me. I would have also
there still would have been a recorder in your face too.
I would have been more upset about the Russell Wilson intentional grounding, which was the right call, if Chris Carson hadn't immediately run for a 16-yard touchdown on the same play. As I mentioned earlier, a very crucial play for me in fantasy football.
God, all you talk about is fantasy football.
It is.
I'm not here with the realness.
Well, can I talk about the New York Giants then?
Absolutely. Speaking of fantasy football, the New York Giants, Colt McCoy.
Colt McCoy Challenge 2020. Let's do it. The Giants started the season 0-5, but have won 4 of their last 6 to climb into first place in the NFC East at 4-7 ahead of Washington football team, thanks to a 2-0 head-to-head record. The Giants lost Saquon Barkley to an ACL tear in week 2 and now likely to be without Daniel Jones after the hamstring injury he suffered in the third quarter Sunday versus Cincinnati. Jones tried to return after missing 2 plays, but immediately left following his next pass attempt. And you just knew when you saw Boggy off there, it was not good.
Yeah. I mean, it just it didn't look good right away, but the subsequent pass attempt where he's like jumping up in the air, holding his hamstring, it's like, oh yeah, okay.
And just nope, can't do this.
We'll see Colt McCoy on Sunday.
McCoy finished out the 1917 win, going 6 of 10 for 31 yards in his first action with the Giants. He has made 3 starts since 2014, all with Washington football team, going 0-3 in those games. Jones ranks just 27th by the Dakota composite put together by Ben Baldwin, but had put together his best 2 games by yards per attempt in the last 2 weeks prior to the injury.
I mean, wasn't that scared of Daniel Jones, but I think statistically, Daniel Jones is a very bad quarterback.
He's better than Carson Wentz, though.
But also, I've watched a hell of a lot of Giants games for whatever reason. Maybe because they've been on national TV a lot.
They're on national TV quite frequently.
And low-key, Daniel Jones is like, he can make some plays.
He's like an entertaining bad quarterback. And like last year, he was like a really bad quarterback. This year, he's just a bad quarterback. You look at his stats, he's in the same ballpark as Matt Stafford and Cam. And
not
all that far from Lamar Jackson.
It wouldn't shock me if Daniel Jones made a Pro Bowl in his career.
That seems reasonable. Although I think many of the listeners have made a Pro Bowl because they just invite anyone at some point.
But I'm saying like he's not such a bad quarterback that I don't foresee him being an NFL starter in like 2 years.
So he's not Drew Locke.
Yeah. And this Seahawks defense is not the kind of defense that could stop Daniel Jones.
It might be. I don't know. They've played much better lately. The rushing DVOA for the Giants has actually improved from last season, despite Saquon's absence. Wayne Goldman tied for 12th.
Generational talent, Saquon.
Football Outsiders value metric DR, despite not claiming the starting job until week 8, has set a new season high for carries each of the last 5 weeks. Alfred Morris also rated shockingly well by DVOA. Devontae Freeman, who hasn't played since week 7, and receiving back Deion Lewis, do not rate shockingly well.
Man,
by DVOA.
This would have been an incredible backfield in like 2012. But it even then would have been like kind of just a fine backfield in 2012.
Colt McCoy and Alfred Morris.
Well, no, Alfred Morris, Deion Lewis, Devontae Freeman.
Yeah, I mean, you're actually a little too early for some of these guys in 2012. They will miss Daniel Jones as a runner. Only Kyler Murray among quarterbacks has more rushing DR this season.
Which is definitely an underrated aspect of Daniel Jones's game. I mean, we saw it obviously with the long run against Philadelphia on Thursday night, but he was quite spry.
Evan Ingram is the Giants' most targeted receiver, but has not been particularly good, catching 58% of his targets for just 3.6 yards per target. Ingram's 7 drops are tied for second most in the NFL with, among others, Tyler Lockett per Sport Radar tracking on Football Reference. Indeed.
Did you hear the mention on the broadcast, by the way, that Tyler Lockett seems to have other interests, but it's very weird.
He doesn't think about football 24/7.
It reminded me of like pre-draft coverage. You know, you almost never see that. Outside of that, it's like, well, you know, Josh Rosen, he cares about stuff other than football, so.
Is Jaylen Brown too smart for his own good?
Once the games start, usually they don't mention stuff like that. Or they treat other interests like it's a positive. But this one was definitely like, you know, Tyler Lockett's got other interests. But DK Metcalf went to Hawaii with Russell Wilson and brought his helmet. Just like, he's still in Hawaii.
Mexico.
Or Mexico, okay.
Giants deep threat Darius Slayton also has caught 58% of his targets, but in his case for 8.8 yards per target because he's, you know, turning more of those into long plays. Sterling Shepard and our old friend Golden Tate slot somewhere in between in terms of yards per target. The Giants defense has been fairly average overall, but better against the run than the pass. Seahawks will be the best pass offense they've played all season. Just 2 of their 11 games so far are against top 10 pass offenses by DVOA. The Giants defense has managed to force a lot of turnovers. They're 8th in turnovers per possession, 5 of those coming against Washington in week 9 and 3 last week against Cincinnati backup quarterback Brandon Allen. Leonard Williams leads the team with six sacks, 1 shy of his career high with the Jets. So
who have they played all year?
They played the NFC East, as it turns out. They also played a game against Chicago. It was one of their out-of-division games in the NFC. And then who else did they manage to get? That there's a terrible offense. They did catch the Cowboys back when they still had Dak Prescott, who was injured during that game. Let's see. Yeah, I guess the Chicago was the only out-of-division horrendous offense they've faced.
Are you looking at their scores right now?
Oh, well, Cincinnati would be the other one without Joe Burrow. Yes, I am.
Okay. Because it's pretty incredible how close these games have been that the Giants have played.
Since they got crushed by the 49ers in week 3, yes. None of their games has been decided by more than 10 points since then, and their largest loss was 17-9 to the Rams.
I mean, they were all within 3 points since the Rams game.
All their losses, yes.
And they had the one win by 10. Like, you know, I think I saw a spread for this one. And granted, that's with Daniel Jones, who I think we can confidently say is a better quarterback than Colt McCoy. So I understand why the spread is what it is, but I think it's probably a little bit too high. Seahawks are like a 9-point favorite or so. 10-point favorite.
When I looked it up earlier this evening.
That feels a little high.
So you're taking the points.
Colt McCoy.
Can I give you one reason to believe that this might be a lopsided game?
What is that?
That's the forecast for Sunday. Partly cloudy, 5% chance of rain. Hello! I mean, that is pretty exciting for the first week of December in Seattle, Washington.
I like it. They're also not playing the Arizona Cardinals.
Can I give you a reason to believe that it will not be a blowout?
What is that?
The Seahawks have literally never played a normal game. They were so close on Monday to playing a normal game, and then they allowed a Hail Mary touchdown in the final minute.
There was nothing about that game that was normal, though, even before then.
I think it was normal. I mean Carson Wentz being bad is normal at this point.
That was normal. It involved like 2 fourth down misses from the Seahawks.
I don't know if that's abnormal.
It involved the Eagles being down. They were down 11. Is that right? When they went for it?
Yes.
When they went for a fourth down. The broadcast actually liked that decision, which was pretty wild. I was like, we've somehow turned a page here.
I don't think that the broadcast liked that decision.
They understood the logic of it. How about that? Of saying that Doug Peterson doesn't feel confident that his offense is going to get back down here. And if you look at it...
Which he should not have.
And if you look at it from the perspective of, like, let's say you kick the field goal, will you have to make a harder fourth down than 4th and 4?
Right.
And
I was actually surprised that was so close on the fourth down, but...
I don't think it was a normal game. This one, maybe there's a chance that it is a normal game. We'll see what happens with Carlos Dunlap. I do think that the defense has played better the last couple of weeks, especially at generating pressure. And I don't think it's just Dunlap that's doing that. If he were to miss the game, like, does that change my percentage chance of victory? Probably not. Maybe a percentage point. And I think that's the good thing about, you know, hopefully, knock on wood, the timing of this injury is, you know, who their opponents are coming up the next couple of weeks. But, and if there was ever a time to not rush Carlos Dunlap back, it is when you have the twosome of the New York teams coming up and one of them starting Colt McCoy.
Well, the other of them starting probably Sam Darnold. Chances of victory?
It probably has to be about 80%.
That's where about where I was as well. Yeah, there's part of me that feels like it should be 85%, but it is the Seahawks, so you can't take anything for granted.
Can we talk about one more point?
Sure.
As it regards, this is more of an overall NFL thing. As it pertains to field goals, I mentioned in the UW Utah postgame podcast that I have a theory that I'm going to say NFL coaches in this scenario, coaches in general, though, that because our stats are NFL based, that coaches overvalue field goals because they haven't adjusted to where the average points per possession are in the NFL now. Whereas a field goal was significantly more valuable 10, 20 years ago than it is now. I mean, I look at a field goal on a drive, and to me, I say that's a failure. And, you know, it is, you went and did the math. And a field goal is
I didn't do any math. I found the page on profootballreference.com. That's what I did.
Okay, perfect. Even better. You went and didn't have to do the math. But
no, I don't do any math. I don't have to.
A field goal is still more points than an average possession.
Dramatically more points than an average possession. The average possession in the NFL this year yields 2.2 points, which is the all-time record, at least. I mean, it is the all-time record, but the data goes back to 98, the possession stats.
I love the idea that pre-98, I don't know if you're familiar with the way football worked, that was definitely the record.
It's pretty clearly the record, yes.
And what was it looking back on previous seasons?
So if you go back about a decade, for example, it was around 1.75 points per possession in the 2010 range. And then around 2000, two decades ago, it was somewhere in the ballpark of 1.6 points per possession. So that is, and this season is a huge jump over anything before because they stopped calling holding. The previous all-time high was 2 points per possession in 2018.
What was it last year?
1.94.
Okay. So it hovered around 2 points and now it shot up to 2.2 points.
You'll remember the 2017 season was when everyone was like, offense is dead. I think there was like some 538 feature about that. It was only 1.8 that year. So it was pretty much in the same territory as 2010 back in 2017. But the last three seasons are the highest on record. So like if your expectation coming into this season is that it probably should have been like 1.95.
But this is still, when you're looking at it on a macro basis, this is a massive increase from where it was 10 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, that's in about 11% jump in the last 10 years, even if you factor out this season's explosion.
And it means that the value of a field goal is not as great anymore as it used to be. You know, the idea of taking the points or playing for field goals is not a consistent way to field an offense. You know, the goal of an offense has to be in an era when teams are scoring more and more points to score touchdowns and to do whatever you can do to maximize your ability to score touchdowns.
You don't make friends with salad and you don't win games with field goals.
You know, it is kind of interesting. I was talking at the like 10, 20 years ago that some of the younger coaches actually seem to be
conservative.
Yes. More of the more conservative coaches.
I don't know, man.
But also,
I guess you get a little older and like Bruce Arians, you start letting her rip. Not like Pete.
We're going to start.
Bruce Arians, yes.
Bruce Arians, Ron Rivera, we're going to start getting real weird.
let's get weird, man.
You think Bruce Arians lets it rip, though? I thought he was actually fairly conservative.
I don't know about his fourth down decisions, but certainly the way his offense works is letting it rip. I'm told the line is actually you don't win friends with salad, so it was actually an even better analogy than I thought it was.
You don't win friends with salad. You don't win football games with field goals. Anyway, I wanted to circle back on that point.
All right. Well, on that note.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks.